Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. My name is Lori, and today I'm being joined by Emily, who you've heard on the podcast before. Emily is actually our brand new Super Feelers co-host. She's our Super Feelers co-facilitator, I suppose, and she's the first addition to our Super Feelers team. So we're super, super excited for that. But today we're actually talking about grief and loss. Emily has gone through some horrendous loss in the last year, and when her and I were kind of chatting about this episode, I referred to her and her best friend as like the Christina and Meredith. If you watch Grey's Anatomy, you'll know exactly what that means. So without going too much into the story, we're going to hear a little bit about what grief means to Emily, how she's coping with it, and just a little bit about this beautiful friendship that she had. So Emily, maybe I'll pass over to you and just give us maybe like, do you want to give us a 2-second introduction of yourself just for people who haven't heard your last episode? And then you can go right into it.
Sure. I am Emily, as Lori said. I have found a home in Super Feelers, and I am just so grateful to be part of that community that has let me in and just given me a safe place to be. So my best friend and I have kind of one of those stories that shouldn't have happened, but did. I met Willa the very first day I ever walked into a treatment facility. I was going in for my eating disorder, and I was walking into an IOP, so it was evening. I was standing at the door, like, ready to bolt, and she was sitting across from me on the couch, completely chill. She's chill. I'm freaking out, like, so she just starts talking to me. And I, like, didn't know what to do. I ended up talking to her. We ended up walking home that night because she lived by me. And then we didn't leave each other's side for 12 years. Our program had said that they didn't want us socializing while we were in the program. However, the closer we got, the worse we got at lying. And the more we, like, would kick each other under the table and end up laughing. So, like, you know, they just kind of let it go eventually because they knew it was going to happen.
That's awesome. That is, like, so exactly how I picture your friendship. It's just, like, getting in shit and kicking each other under the table. So how long were you actually in treatment together?
So I don't know the full length of time because we were in multiple times
together,
on and off. And I will testify that I was on and off at the same eating disorder center and in various levels of care. But we are terrible at lying when we're together. The other thing is that Willa also carried a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. And she knew I had it. I knew she had it. It was an open discussion, which made it really easy, because we both knew we were up against kind of the same thing. And we both could piss each other off really well, but also make up really well.
That there's nothing like the connection between two people with borderline, in my opinion. There's just nothing like it.
I mean, I would agree, especially because we started seeing the same, like, physician and then driving her crazy. So yeah.
Sounds like a beautiful friendship. So was there anything, like, particular about her, like, other than the kind of similar diagnoses, but, like, what was it about her that you guys connected so quickly?
I mean, her personality was one of those that just, like, lit up a room. We had the same sense of really strange and dark humor. One of the things that, like, stuck out for me, we brought those, like, hands that you can throw and they, like, stick on walls. And we
did, love those.
We had the group room ceiling covered by the time everybody came in. So we kind of had the same, like, playfulness and, like, you know, desire to, like, make mischief happen, but, like, not really. but we both were looking for adventure in really safe ways.
That's a really good way of putting it. So I think I remember, at least, like, I think the Super Feelers Club happened like pretty soon after you lost her. Do you want to talk a little bit about like the day of the accident?
Sure. So I consider there to be a before and a now. If you tell me now it's November, I would probably believe you because everything stopped. It has not started again. So at the end of May, Willa and her family had flown across the country for a much needed vacation. And she and I had been texting and talking on the phone the whole time. And suddenly she stopped answering. And I kind of was like, okay, maybe she like went somewhere with her parents, like, you know, whatever it is, people don't text back right away. The next day we all get called. And by we, I mean our close, like her close group of friends. But because my social media and my phone are on lockdown from previous jobs, it took people about 6.5 hours to get to me. All I remember in the very beginning was screaming at my friend, telling him he was lying to me. I called the primary care physician that we had shared, knowing that she would pick up in this circumstance if it was true. The second right. I heard her voice, it was over. And time hasn't really restarted. My life hasn't really restarted. And it's, there's no real way to explain it eloquently.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially just you two were attached at the hip, right? So, you know, yeah, people's phones die, whatever, but you go, I'm sure you hadn't gone like 24 hours without talking to each other in 12
years. We had not gone that long, and I can't remember mm-hmm. how many years. And we had texted about 9 minutes prior to everything happening.
Wow.
We weren't contacted that night because there was a time difference. There were family members that had to fly in. All of those things had to happen. And, you know, the arrangements had to be made for everybody going on, and her dad did survive it. So that was a whole other kind of component. So her friends knew like the next morning at like 9 o'clock, except me.
And it was like friends that were contacting you, or like, how were you guys being contacted?
So her brother had gone out like late that night, which is why none of us had been called. I think he had one of our friends' numbers, and it was kind of like a game of phone tag. However, first of all, this is not the best game of phone tag I've ever been involved in, but I didn't receive any of it. And everybody was trying me on every platform they could. One friend finally got through because he realized that we had hung out in a group before. So he could get through to me on Facebook Messenger. And then I called him and screamed at him and told him he was lying at me.
Yeah, which is a totally valid reaction, right? Like, what else are you supposed to do? Like, your brain can't wrap your head around what that actually means.
Yeah, I have no clue.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything else than yelling at him.
Yeah. I mean, and like, again, we talk about dissociation a lot, like dissociation's valid and like, it's actually a protection mechanism. So like, if you don't remember anything, that's probably because your brain was trying to protect you.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that it being not in the state that I'm in means that it wasn't on the news here. It wasn't like something that would have been printed or talked about. And so it felt like they were still just on vacation.
Right.
And yeah. That made it much harder.
Yeah. You could kind of like pretend almost that like it wasn't true.
Yeah, because we were still taking care of animals at that point and plants, and it felt like the routine we were asked to hold.
So after that dissociation period, I mean, obviously I'm sure that it still comes and goes, but when did you start to feel that like grief really started to hit you?
Gosh. I think it like sort of just started coming in these really weird waves where initially it was when people would start telling me about it. And I was like, dude, like, no, it's like, if you look at my Facebook, you'll see it. Cool. Leave me alone. Thanks. I think the first time I realized I was really upset was the night I had a panic attack about pajamas not matching and called my mom at midnight. And I was like, I don't know what to do. It's not that hard to find a t-shirt and shorts. But right. I couldn't handle the fact that I didn't have the ones that matched hers. I didn't know what to do with myself.
It's so interesting what sticks, right?
Yeah, it became this like very fast, instead of like the normal BPD cycle that's like a couple hours at a time, I started like flinging myself through like the space-time continuum, it felt like. And I think it was hard because I was also having TMS during like all of this and had to go. And so every morning I'd wake up, re-experience the whole thing.
Sorry, do you want to just explain for our listeners what that is, just in case they don't know?
Basically, it's magnetic picture brain from being depressed because no medication worked on me.
Yeah, I think we've had an episode with Lucia about it where they put like electrodes on your brain and then they like do weird things, and it's like for people who are treatment resistant to medication generally.
Correct. Which made it very difficult.
Right, because you have to go like every day or something, right?
And my time was in the morning, which meant I had to get out of bed. I wore pajamas every day. I cried through the whole thing. And they were like, about this? And I was like, it's fine. I don't want to talk about it. It's fine. I have a team assigned to me from the Department of Mental Health in my state. And they also started getting really hands-on. So I had like two teams of providers. People were calling me all the time. Like they were constantly checking in because I had no idea what was going on in my head.
And I remember you, hope this is okay for me to say, and if not, we'll just cut it. But I remember like in Super Feelers, you were very much like, I can't stay alive without her. It's just not a thing I can do.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So I can see where your care team was like, oh shit, we got to like wrap around ASAP.
Oh, did they ever? Because my like state provided team has endless people and resources. So like there were people all over who required video calls or phone calls or photos that like my brain was still there.
That's awesome that you had such a great team wrapping around you though. Like, holy shit.
Yeah. And my outpatient team has really like stepped it up. My psychiatrist when she found out, she was like, go to CVS. Just everything's been called in already because she knew I wasn't going to sleep. I think the harder part though, and not to minimize anything I've been through or anybody else has been through, but this is the first big T trauma event that I cannot blame myself for. Like, I can justify everything else that's happened to me as, well, that's my life. Like, these are the things that I caused or created or happened because I was in the wrong situation. I can't logic myself out of this. And that aspect of it was what made it so difficult to even think about accepting it, because there was nothing in my brain that could blame myself for it. even if I had been there, I couldn't have changed it.
Right. Yeah. It was just like kind of a fluke. Like it just happened so quickly and out of nowhere that like nobody could have done anything.
I mean, they didn't see it coming. I talked to her 9 minutes before. They literally did not see it happening. So they didn't feel any pain, but I can justify everything else that I've gone through.
Right. Which is also like, I'm sure 99% of those traumas aren't like your fault, but I can see where like justifying them to yourself as, you know what I mean? Like I think we've all done that. You're also older now, right? Like this is like very much present time, real, your support person, right? Like I don't know your whole trauma history and I don't need to know your whole trauma history, but presumably a lot of those things happened, you know, many, many years ago. And when you were probably a child, right? So,
correct.
Yeah. So like, it's different now, you know, like you found this person as part of your healing from that past trauma. And now this person is gone. And that must just be even harder.
I will say, so I would never call her a favorite person because we had an equal two-way friendship the whole time. I will say, as attachment goes, I think we are probably each other's first like safe, secure attachment. Right. Because I didn't have it growing up. She didn't have it growing up. We were in a place with each other that like, if something was going on, all you needed was a phone call and like the other person's on the way.
Right. And that's who you would have called in this situation, right? Had this happened to any other human being on earth, she would have been your first call.
I did try and call her.
Well, yeah. You know what? I've done that too. I had a couple of friends that have passed away and I texted them immediately and you're like, this doesn't make any sense, but I'm going to do it anyways. And there's nothing I can do about it.
I didn't stop texting her until Christmas.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's what we need to feel like, some sort of normalcy, right?
Yeah. Every time I go somewhere or do something, it feels like walking out of my house without my keys. It feels like walking out of my house, forgetting something perpetually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always doubling back being like, okay, do I have my keys? Do I have my phone?
Really? And what then am I forgetting? Yeah.
And it's her. I'm not going to see her. She's not with me. And then that in and of itself dysregulated me like daily.
Mm-hmm. I bet. And so in terms of, I mean, obviously the dysregulation like that, it would obviously that's going to be a huge factor of this. But did you find that there were other ways that it impacted your emotions that you weren't maybe expecting or that you wanted to share?
Yeah. So trauma work that I had, I don't consider any of it finished, but stabilized, flooded back. I still don't sleep more than 5 hours. We are almost at the year mark and I still cannot sleep more than 5 hours at a time. I feel like all of the things that I had worked to have patience with out the window. And then the behaviors that I had worked so hard on came flying back at probably the speed I was driving my car. Which.
And those behaviors like self-harm and eating challenges and that kind of thing?
So I had several months of no self-harm. I was doing really well with it. That went away real fast. And I have been struggling with it ever since. And it's frustrating because I'm not happy that I'm struggling with it, but here we are. Interestingly enough, while eating has been a challenge, it's sort of survival mode. So I'm doing enough that I'm not in need of like hospitalization or anything. But I don't think I would consider it like normalized.
Right. Yeah. But it's not to the point where you were before, like years ago, where correct. You were like very ill. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm like this, you know what? Like self-harm is a coping mechanism, whether or not it's the best coping mechanism. We can debate that all day, but like, you got to do what you got to do. And if that's what you have to do in this moment, that's okay. And you can keep working on that. I mean, I'm sure many people that listen to this podcast, myself included, like never thought self-harm would not be part of our lives. You know what I mean? Like even if, you know, like, yeah, I've had like a long period where I haven't self-harmed, but it still is in my brain. Like,
right.
Don't get me wrong. It's still in my brain all the time.
But like everything impulsive, that I would like think about and then not do, I started doing. Rejection sensitivity through the roof. Anybody that like looked at me and I thought I had offended them, I would burst into tears. Anything that would have been stressful at like a level 5 became like a level 100. My friends got me out of the house for the first time, I think in July. And it was to go to a concert, which was like probably the best thing they could have done. I can't tell you how much of it I cried through. So I ended up starting a list of public places I cried in that she would have laughed at me for.
I love it.
It's very long. But it feels like communication is definitely harder because the world expects you to take 2 weeks off of work, go back and be fine.
Totally. It's,
that's not how my life is going to ever be.
Mm-hmm.
And the other really unique thing is that we were both on disability. We were both had the same day structure. So we had our own structure that we had formed. And so that missing is like, hi, you're not working. Like it brought back all of that shame that I carried.
Right. I had, you didn't have like your partner. Like,
yeah. Like we had our own schedule. But the mood swings were terrible. They're still terrible. And then being caught off guard isn't just like a jump scare. It's a full-blown meltdown, can't control it. Need the like crisis line, like everything,
like just in general, like any sort of like kind of thing that jolts you.
So I can give you this is the best example. I was at a concert, really innocent. The artist that was performing at the time was like, who's here with their best friend? And the friend that I was with, we looked at each other. We're pretty close, but like she clearly didn't want to disrespect me and I didn't know her. Like it was so awkward. And then the artist continued to speak about best friends. I made it through the show because I kept telling myself that if I cried in front of this girl one more time, like eventually she's going to like want to punch me in the face.
But
the second I got to my car, I couldn't drive for like a solid half an hour. And that's the caught off guard part. Like,
gotcha.
Didn't expect that to become, like, I did not expect to go to a concert and have that be the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the State Department team has their own crisis line. And I have a safety plan that goes with it. So they all have it. And I was on the phone with them for like a solid hour.
Good for you using that skill. Because like calling the crisis line is a skill in itself because that shit's hard to do when you're in that dysregulation phase.
Yeah. I think if it wasn't run by clinicians that I knew, I don't know if I would have had the like courage to do it.
Totally. Yeah. That's honestly, it sounds like you like have a really good setup, which is super cool. Or like the state has a good setup, I'd rather. So I think we've kind of touched on this, but your ability to stay alive, just knowing you as a person and hearing you over the last year, how has this impacted your ability to stay alive.
Woof. I will be completely honest. There is a lot of ambivalence, but I am completely safe. There's nothing like going through my head about it. I just don't like the idea of continuing in a world that she's not in. I don't like the idea of moving to an apartment that she'll never see. I don't like all of those like things that will happen going forward. I don't like the idea that she won't physically be next to me. And right. A lot of people really like to give me unsolicited advice that happens to go with their spirituality about how I'm always carrying her with me and all these things. And while it's all good natured and well-meaning, I mean it literally.
Yeah. I was going to ask actually, like, are you a spiritual or a religious person? And then how does that impact? But it sounds like you're not. And I'm just curious.
So Willa and I spent a lot of time chasing sunrises and sunsets. So all summer, I mean a group of us in different states and areas and stuff, we're chasing pink sunsets. And I don't know what I believe, but it's comforting to know that everybody looks the same moon. Like, no matter where we were, we're all looking at the same thing.
Yeah, totally.
As far as religion, I was brought up with like basic Judaism, but not sure how I feel about that right now.
Totally. And that's fine. Also, this is like a question that you totally may not want to answer on a podcast that's going to be listened to by a bajillion people.
No,
But I mean, I just wonder because I find religion is such an interesting thing when it comes to grief. Because if you're religious, it means death means something completely different than if you're not.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah. I think that was like the thing that I learned week one.
Mm-hmm, totally. Because it's all people talk about. And it's hard to not, right?
Yeah. The other thing that is of note is that Willa and I were both medically complicated. So we were used to going to each other's appointments for small procedures, whatever it was. So when I would literally say, I need her next to me, I do not mean that I need her in my head.
Right. Like
I need
figuratively,
to hold
yeah.
my hand while somebody is like, doing a thing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
By the time the summer was over, I was ready to like scream. And I appreciated that her family chose to do a celebration of life versus traditional like services. And they were done in the fall. And I was given an amazing honor to be allowed to speak and to be part of planning. And I think if I've ever needed validation about her family being my family, that's all I have to think about.
Mm-hmm.
I knew everybody at the service and she knew my extended family too. So, but the way that I was treated was one of them and it was beautiful.
That is beautiful.
But back to the ambivalence, because I know we just totally went off.
I think it's a really important conversation to have though, but yeah, go back to the ambivalence for sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to be mindful of like where my brain goes.
That's okay.
So in the beginning, it was a lot of, well, I can't leave while her dad's in the state because that like he's counting on me to do things. You know, I've been close with her forever. So there was like a little bit of like bribing myself, even though I had no plan and no intent at all. But it was kind of my like, remember that this is happening. So Willa's other best friend, Hillary, she and I have become really close. We met Willa within the same 6 months. And it's very obvious as to why Willa chose both of us. We're very similar. and we clicked immediately. We basically knew each other before we met. She and I talk every day now, and we check in with each other about anything and everything. And she knows that I'm completely ambivalent, and we talk about it. And I think that's been one of my like protective factors, is still having a connection that's that strong, where we have videos to share with each other, clothing of hers, all of that stuff. And she's not too far away from me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's played a really big role in finding support, because through all of this, in my true borderline fashion of like push pull, not knowing what the heck I needed, I started to realize that the people who I wanted around me were the people who knew us when, who knew us in the very beginning of like us being a fusion. And I didn't want anybody else around me. Like, if they didn't know her, and if they didn't know her in the context of us being fused together, nope. See ya. And so in that sense, it was definitely hard to figure out how to get what I needed met from like my peers, essentially.
Yeah, I'm glad that you have that relationship with her best friend too, because that you're going through very similar things. I don't know if the best friend has any mental health challenges. You don't have to say that on the air, because that's not our business, but you know, it might still look very different for us with BPD to go through this, but at least you have somebody who kind of like understands the person and can like have the same inside jokes and like understand what's going on and all that.
I think the thing in addition to that is the feeling of guilt when I go out and I'm doing something that I'm supposed to enjoy. So I called her after the concert and I was like, why can't I just have fun? And right. She's like, I know. Because she had been to Disney earlier in the year. And she's like, I know. I was at freaking Disney. And so I hate that she has to know. I hate it. I hate that she has to understand this. And she literally understands it. And so we're traveling through it completely together. We also share the same fear, which is forgetting any little detail.
And so, it sounds like between the two of you, you're going to keep that memory alive.
100%.
So what skills have been keeping you alive today? Because I remember just under a year ago, you were not convinced about wanting to stay alive by any stretch. I don't think it was even ambivalence at that point. It was very much intent. At least that's how it came across.
Oh no, you're correct. You're 100% correct. The state team that was put together, and then I had a lot of say in it. We made safety plans that I still carry every day with me, and they have one that they have all on their phones. So if I call crisis, they know exactly what to do, and they know what to do if I'm driving, if I'm out, and if I'm home. Night routines and morning routines became incredibly important.
I think you talked about that on your last episode with us, about you have like lists on your phone for these routines that are really important to you.
Yeah. And we've like instated some, like you can stay home, but you have to like change rooms every 3 hours or, you know, whatever it may be.
Right. So you can't just like lay in bed all day for a week.
No, absolutely not. And I think what I've done and what my team has encouraged me to do is I've set up distractions that are always in every room in arm's reach.
Mm.
So in my bedroom, I have my Kindle and I have an iPad, because reading is the greatest way to bring me out of my head, or if I need a show or anything else. Next to my kitchen, there's like this little alcove, and I have it all set up with a painting project I'm working on. And then in my living room, I can, within arm's reach, grab crossword puzzles, diamond art, and coloring.
And all your juggling stuff, right?
Yes. So that has been amazing for me. One of my providers got me back into it because I had stopped doing anything. But movement has always been a really big part of my life. And that was the thing that I couldn't find a way to restart because I couldn't find a way to get off the couch. So they had me juggling. I don't remember what the, like, there was like an assignment or a challenge or a dare. Something that was like, fine, I'll show you. And it kind of morphed. And eventually I got a custom set made. And then I bought rings, which you need some clearance for. And I just bought clubs, which, dear God, I'm going to break everything in my house. I need to do sajors.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And it's become this wonderful kinesthetic release, which is helping my self-harm urges between the hours of 9 a.m. and about 7 p.m. before I like feel terrible that I have neighbors.
Right.
Right. Like I just, if I didn't have neighbors and I wasn't in a building, I would do this at 3 a.m.
Right. But the fact that even between 9 and 7, that it's helping with your self-harm urges, that's still like major progress.
Yeah. Because it's the only thing where I can throw objects safely. Like, yeah. I can throw objects furiously. And I can, what I'll do is I'll put on like my angry playlist and I will try and make myself match the exact tempo.
That's super
and
cool.
So it's like I consider it rage juggling. Like, I'm not working on tricks. I'm not working on anything. I am just getting it out of my system as fast as I can.
That's awesome, though. That's amazing. I love it.
I'm actually going to be teaching the team at DMH, I think in a month or two. I'm teaching 20 of them.
Cool.
So it'll be fun. Yeah.
Awesome. And what about other skills? So like the juggling's been huge. The having like distractions has been huge. I know that you use the tip skill quite a bit.
I use it and I use it very strangely in terms of not ice packs. Willa right. and I had a popsicle thing where we spent 2 summers looking for every popsicle we could find that we liked. There was a shortage 1 year during the pandemic. Just so you know. So I actually use popsicles and not as ice packs. I will eat them.
That's awesome though. Cause that's like multiple skills at once.
Yeah. But that's what I do. And it's a thing that also brings me back right to her and keeps that connection. And is one of the funnier stories that we have because there are pictures of us just back and forth with, I can't find this. I found this at that supermarket. They only had one box of these.
I love it. Yeah, pandemic supply chains were a weird thing, I have to say.
But we spent the whole pandemic together, which I think left me in a place that I don't think many people can say, which is that the time that we had together, I have no regret about the way we used it. Like when the state lines were open, we would drive just to go take a walk in another state. We would go hiking in a place that we thought would be like less populated. We would go take a walk at dusk, whatever it happened to be, because we're both immunocompromised. We're both adventure seekers. So we were like, all right, we got to do something else.
Yeah, it was the perfect partnership for that time for sure.
We tried every single craft project Michael's had. I don't know how to phrase this like beautifully, but like it was the best way if it had to end that it could have in that sense, because our friendship had never been stronger. There was nothing left unsaid. We always had a phrase that if I was doing or she was doing airport drop-offs, if we wrote each other letters, it was always forever and always to the moon and back, I love you. And right before she left for California, we did get to say that to each other one more time. So that I am very thankful for.
I'm so glad that you were able to have that last little communication with her and such a great relationship.
And I now have it tattooed in her handwriting on my arm. Forever and always, to the moon and back, I love you.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.